My name is Harmon Spolin. I'm a member of the Cozen O'Connor Law Firm, and it's my pleasure to welcome you here today. Before introducing our distinguished speaker, Alireza Jafarzadeh, let me take a moment or two to tell you about the Middle East Forum's important work and encourage you to join its efforts. Under the direction of the renowned Daniel Pipes, the Middle East Forum works to define and promote American interests in the Middle East. It has consistently displayed an unparalleled grasp of issues such as exposing the threat posed by radical Islam, developing strategies to contain the Iranian threat, working for Palestinian acceptance of Israel, urging the Bush administration to better manage its democracy efforts, and Campus Watch Project, which critiques the extremist orthodoxy that dominates Middle East studies at universities in the United States. Its activities include research. It publishes the Middle East Quarterly, which is the authoritative journal of Middle East affairs, and MES scholars appear regularly in major publications all over the world. It is involved in media work and in public education, such as today's program. Please add your email address to the sign-up sheet that you were asked to do when you walked into the luncheon today, in order to receive the forum's materials as they appear, or you can go on the forum's website, which is meforum.org. We're going to have a question and answer period after the presentation, so I ask that you hold your comments until then. The Middle East Forum is pleased to present Alireza Jafarzadeh in a discussion of the Iranian threat. The Islamist regime in Iran is already destabilizing the Middle East, and its potential acquisition of nuclear weaponry poses a deep threat to the entire globe. Our speaker is an Iranian dissident known for having exposed Iran's nuclear program and proving Iranian involvement in several international terrorist attacks. In his new book, The Iranian Threat, President Ahmadinejad and the Coming Nuclear Crisis, which is here through the Joseph Fox Bookshop, Mr. Jafarzadeh brings to light Iran's latest efforts to hide its nuclear facilities, as well as the regime's covert operations inside Iran. He traces Ahmadinejad's history of torturing political prisoners, his pedigree as a protege of Iran's radical mullahs, and his zealous, long-standing quest to make Iran a nuclear power. The author offers insights and policy recommendations on how to end the Iranian threat. Our speaker is president of Strategy and Policy Consulting, Inc., which is based in Washington, and is a foreign affairs analyst for Fox News. He served as a U.S. spokesman for the National Coalition of Resistance of Iran, and his articles have been published in the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the Wall Street Journal. So please join me in welcoming Alireza Jafarzadeh.
Thank you very much. Really appreciate this opportunity today. I have to, first of all, thank Dr. Daniel Pipes, who's not here, but I understand he's on the road overseas, for making this happen. But particularly, I want to thank Angela Rosen for putting this event together, and thank Sir Spolin for this very warm and nice introduction. Now, I was thinking on the way we're discussing with my colleague David how I'm going to spend the 20 minutes here and what are the issues that we need to focus on. Obviously, the Iranian threat is the topic of my book, and I can go extensively to all the details about the Iranian threat and why it's so serious and so real. But I thought that we probably have to spend a little bit more time on the solution, because as we all agree, finally after some 4 years, people are beginning to realize that the threat is for real. Why the threat is for real is simply look at the situation next door in Iraq. 4 years after the war, we had General David Petraeus and Ambassador Crocker going through 2 days of extensive debates and, you know, testimony and questions, both on the House and the Senate side. And their bottom line was that, if I really want to summarize it, is that the situation is very serious, that the violence has actually gone up, and they both referred to the role of the Iranian regime as a regime that is conducting a proxy war in Iraq and having a very deadly operation in that country. Now, I'm glad that this is recognized after 4 years. I recall it was October of 2003. I did an op-ed piece in the Baltimore Sun highlighting the role of the Iranian regime in Iraq, what their intentions are, and what their agenda is, and what they're doing right now. And I just don't understand why it took so long and so many casualties and so much time and opportunity lost before we've come to this conclusion. In one word, the Iranian regime is basically dominating everything in Iraq. We're talking about the political process in that country. That political process is dominated by the Iranian regime. We're talking about the killings, the violence that's going on every day. The bombs are being built in Iran. I'm talking not about ordinary bombs, but I'm talking about the most advanced, sophisticated bombs, known as the EFPs, explosively formed projectiles that can actually penetrate through armor, is now the number one killer of the American forces in Iraq. And guess what? Those bombs are built in Iran, and I know exactly where they're built, and I revealed the information thanks to the information provided by the main Iranian opposition, known as the Mujahideen Khalq, that has a network inside Iran, and they managed to find out exactly where those are being bombed. Those bombs are being built. It's in a district in Tehran, Labizan district, under the order of the Iranian Revolutionary Guards, specifically the Quds Force, which is the deadliest force within the Revolutionary Guards, and then sent across the border, provided to the militias that are funded and trained by the Iranian regime. We're talking about the funding of this operation, which is extremely expensive. Iran is spending $70 million a month funding this operation there. As we speak, the Iran regime has as many as 32,000 of its agents in Iraq. These are Iraqis who are on the payroll of Tehran, 32,000. And this includes very high-level influential individuals who are now in the Iraqi government, who occupy the most sensitive positions within the security apparatus of Iraq, running the local operations in various provinces, involved in the security operation, the Interior Ministry, the the defense ministry, the police, and also in the parliament. Interestingly, it was January of this year that I reveal the name of one of these individuals, one of the 32,000. His name is Abu Mehdi Mohandes, who was a sitting member of parliament. And I said, you know, this is the person who was engaged in terrorist operations in the 90s in Kuwait. And he was actually wanted by the Interpol for being involved in the plotting bombing in the embassy there, the American embassy in Kuwait. He was actually jailed for a period by the Kuwaitis, and then when Iraq, Saddam Hussein attacked Kuwait, he escaped prison, went back to Iran, underwent all kinds of trainings, then got back to Iraq in 2003, later ran for election, was elected as a member of parliament. He was a sitting member of parliament. And based on that information, the U.S. Government acted, and then it became very clear that not only that information was true, but they were able to gather more intelligence about that. By that time, it was too late. He had already escaped back to Iran. There were extensive reporting about that on CNN. New York Times had a couple of major articles about this one individual that I'm talking about. That's the kind of network that the Iran regime has been running in Iraq. And given the whole history and the background of, you know, we had 8 years of war between Iran and Iraq. As far as Iran was concerned, their agenda was to establish an Islamic Republic in Iraq, very much modeled after Iran. And the theological schools in Najaf and some in Karbala were dominated by some of these clerics who are now ruling in Iran. And there's 1,200 kilometers of common border all along the border from north to the middle part to down south in Basra. They have had the tremendous access across the border. In the first few months after the fall of Baghdad in 2003, there were some 3 million Iranian pilgrims who went to Najaf and Karbala for religious, you know, ceremonies. And many of them didn't even have passports. So you can imagine if ordinary citizens can get to Iraq that easily, what kind of an operation the Iranian Minister of Intelligence, the whole, you know, the Quds Force were conducting in Iraq. There was one of the prominent members of the Iraqi National Assembly was in Washington yesterday. And he's a Shia cleric himself, but Mr. Sayyid Ayad Jamaluddin. And his point of view was that Iraq is already controlled by Iraq in every aspect. He said the parliament, you know, the same assembly that he was sitting in, is dominated by them. It's Iran that says, okay, this minister will get the post, the other minister will not get the post. And it's Iran that influences the outcome of just about everything there. Therefore, if you really want to fix the problem there, you really need to address the threat of the Iranian regime. And nothing will happen unless that issue is addressed. And I was glad that at least some of that was mentioned in the Petraeus Crocker report yesterday in Washington. We talked about the nuclear threat earlier. This becomes even more serious when you combine the prospect of the Iran regime getting the nuclear bomb with that, their ideology of religious extremism, Islamic extremism. The combination of the two will give you the nightmare scenario. Some people argue, well, you know, you have India, you have Pakistan, other countries who have the nuclear bomb. But that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about a regime that wants to expand, to dominate the whole world. The Ayatollahs in Tehran believe in the global Islamic rule. And they're starting from Iraq, and they would want to expand it way beyond the Iraqi situation. And a nuclear bomb would give them the kind of leverage they need, both in the region, but also domestically, because domestically the Iran regime is in trouble. And therefore, whatever they do outside, whether their involvement in the the violent intervention in Iraq, their support for terrorist groups around the world, or their effort to get the nuclear bomb, would help them with their survival. Now, the nuclear program is very, very serious. I've discussed extensively in the book, the four chapters of the book are actually about the nuclear program of the Iranian regime specifically. That program has been significantly enhanced, especially since Ahmadinejad took office as the new president of the Iranian regime. Given his background, the former commander of the Revolutionary Guards, specifically a top commander of the Quds force, the deadliest force of the Iranian regime, that has done nothing but terrorism. Now, Ahmadinejad is at the helm as the new president, the head of the executive branch, with the backing of the Revolutionary Guards, with the backing of the Supreme Leader, and the agenda he's trying to accomplish really makes it a very scary situation. I've noticed that, especially in the past 2 years, the Iranian regime's nuclear weapons program has been brought increasingly under the control of the Revolutionary Guards. That's the first thing that you notice, that it's the Revolutionary Guards, really, that is calling the shots. They are gaining more and more control of the program than it was before. There are actually a number of military sites controlled by the Revolutionary Guards that are doing R&D, research and development, on the nuclear weapons program of the Iran regime, and none of them have been inspected by the International Atomic Energy Agency, IAEA. There are a number of other sites that I mentioned that Revolution Guards experts, some of whom have very high ranks within the Revolutionary Guards, are working on the nuclear material, on the nuclear research, and they have not been interviewed by the IAEA. And the second thing is that they're moving the program increasingly underground into tunnels and underground facilities. There were a number of tunnels that my sources in Iran associated with the main opposition, as I mentioned earlier, discovered these underground facilities and exposed them, none of which have been inspected by the IAEA so far. As far as I know, none of them have been mentioned even in the reports. And it's crucial, why? Because the reason we know about the whole nuclear weapons program of Iran is because of the Iranian opposition. It was the Mujahideen Khal who revealed the nuclear sites in Natanz, in Iraq, in Karaj, and in Lashkarabad, and other places. If it weren't for this, the information by this opposition, no one would know anything about the program. There were no inspections by the IAEA of any Iranian sites at all until August of 2002, when these sites were revealed by the opposition. So when they speak, when they reveal information, new information, this needs to be taken very, very seriously. And there are still a lot of unanswered questions, things that have not even been addressed at all. And that really adds to the worry. And the third element is that Iran has really sped up the nuclear weapons program under Ahmadinejad. There's been major progress in Natanz, which is the main uranium enrichment facility. They're moving forward very rapidly in Iraq, which would give Iran the additional ability of eventually developing plutonium, which is a second way of getting fissile material for the bomb. And they're spending so much resources, and nothing has been slowed down, let alone being stopped as a result of these negotiations. So we really need to look at this very seriously. So the question is, so what do we do? What is the answer to this very, very serious problem, both in terms of Iraq, Iran involvement in Iraq, and also in terms of Iran itself. I think the solution is somewhat interrelated. The same way that the problem in Iraq is related to Iran, I think the solution is also interrelated. And here is what I think needs to be done by the United States government, by the coalition forces, if they want to address the Iranian threat in Iraq. First of all, you need to make up your mind that you have to change your policy. I don't care who is in the administration, whether they're Democrats or Republicans. This is way beyond politics. I don't get involved into the into that. I think what we need to do, we have to understand that you need to pursue a policy in Iraq that would go after the sources of violence. We know what borders these bombs are coming into Iraq. Those borders need to be stopped. We know where these terrorist trainings are. The access needs to be stopped. We know which individuals are acting as proxies for Tehran. The Iranian opposition, the Mujahideen Haq, they released the list of the 32,000 agents of Tehran with names and particulars and all the details, what agencies they were working at. So they need to be stopped. They need to be purged. You cannot allow the militias 4 years after the fall of Baghdad. Still, you have the streets of Baghdad and Basra and other places dominated by these Shiite militias. How can you talk about an independent Iraq? How can you talk about a secure Iraq? How can you talk about prospects for political process where a lot of these so-called parties who are nothing more than, you know, entities created, a lot of them actually created by Tehran, based on, you know, sectarian divides, having their own militias. You had the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq having their own Badr Brigade, which was the military arm of that. And they were trained and really created in Tehran for so many years, and then they entered Iraq, keeping their identity. Even, you know, introducing candidates for the parliament with the same identity, and then, you know, 4 years later, you still have the same situation. That needs to end immediately. The militias need to be disarmed, disbanded immediately. And the government, the Iraqi government, needs to be purged of the elements who are getting their orders from Tehran. You cannot speak of an independent Iraq when a lot of these ministers are more concerned about Iran than their own country. Prime Minister Maliki, at many occasions, he has really acted on behalf of Tehran. I'm sorry to say this, but this is a reality we need to recognize. Right before his trip to Tehran, a short while ago, about 2 months ago, he made a statement saying that the main Iranian opposition that has bases in Iraq, the Mujahideen Khal, in Ashraf City, they need to leave the country. They need to be disbanded. Why? He said because they're a threat to Iran. Now, are you concerned about the security of Iran or the security of Iraq? He has not made any statements about the Shiite militias who are running the streets of Baghdad and Basra, all these death squads who are responsible for the killings. There are about 100 bodies found in Iraq every day, and nothing is being done by the Maliki government, and he is concerned about the Iranian opposition. Well, I guess that tells me, in fact, that is the solution. The fact that the Iranian opposition in Iraq has managed to unify the moderate voices of the Iraqis is what really hurts Tehran and what really hurts the more radical elements in Iraq. So you cannot see a solution in Iraq if you only focus on the threat and try to kill and disband the bad guys. You need to empower the more moderate voices in Iraq, which I believe strongly is actually the majority of Iraq. The majority of Iraq are those who are the moderates, whether it's the Shiites or the Sunnis. Those radical Shiites do not represent the sentiments of the Shia majority in Iraq. We're talking about a small group that is armed, is well trained, well funded by the neighboring country, and obviously dominates, intimidates the more moderate elements. I was speaking to this moderate Shiite cleric, which I mentioned earlier, and he told me stories after stories how a lot of the moderate voices were simply eliminated, murdered, killed, their family members targeted. So these are the voices that need to be strengthened. And how do you do that? You need to offer them, share with them the experience of fighting Islamic extremism. And the Iraqi population never had that experience. The Iranian people did. The Iranian people have been fighting for 27 years against the Ayatollahs. And this particular opposition, the Mujahideen al-Khalq, who have presence in Iraq, they have been trying to share their experience of how you really stand up against the clerics. How do you stand up and differentiate between your own religion and the Islamic extremists who are ruling in Tehran? They try to educate the public about the difference. They were forming conferences, seminars, gatherings in their base in Ashraf City. And the Iraqis, Sunnis, Shiites, Kurds, tribal leaders would go there and get together. And they managed to move away the Sunnis who were fighting the Americans, especially in the early days after the fall of Baghdad, moving them away from insurgency, telling them, doesn't matter what you think about the Americans, the result of this fighting will end up in the pocket of the Ayatollahs in Tehran, because they will pick up the outcome, and they would dominate your country. So try to participate in the political process. And they tried to empower the more moderate voices of the Shiites. That's what has really angered Tehran. I think there is a good possibility that if these moderate voices are further empowered, and the way to empower them is to show them that they are on the winning side and the more extremist elements are on the losing side. If the United States sit down at the negotiating table with Tehran, trying to forge a plan for security of Iraq, what kind of a signal is that sending to the moderate voices? If it is true that the reason that they're sitting at the table with that the U.S. is sitting at the table with Iran is because they are the main problem there, they are the instigators of violence there, then you cannot ask them to end the violence. It's not going to happen. It hasn't happened. It has even made it worse. And it sends a signal. It angers the more moderate voices. And it just tells them that, U.S. is not really serious about this. So what you want to do, you want to send a strong signal of decisiveness and firmness to the Iranian regime, number one, to all their proxies and their agents in Iraq, and then side with the more moderate voices of Iraqis in that country, and and act against Tehran's demand. Tehran says the Mujahideen al-Khalq should be dismantled. You need to side with the voice of Iraqis who say, no, we need them here. We need them here as our protection. There were some 5.2 million Iraqis who signed a petition in favor of the continued presence of the Mujahideen Khalq in Iraq, because they want to use their experience against Tehran. And the last thing you need to do, the last point is that the United States need to put Tehran on the defensive. Right now, the Ayatollahs are on the offensive. They feel everything is going well for them. They're moving the nuclear program forward. They're instigating violence in Iraq. And they have found Americans weak. You know, no matter how much violence Tehran is instigating, the U.S. is still going back to the negotiating table, asking the Tehran to please end violence in Iraq. Can you please stop your uranium enrichment program? Could you please negotiate with us? We're going to give you a package of incentives. We'll give you all the things you want if you only stop your nuclear weapons program. Do you think the Ayatollahs will buy that? What they do, actually, they say, you know what? The United States is hopeless. They are weak. That means that we have to move forward even more rapidly. This is the opportunity. This is the time for us to do it. What is the reality as far as Iran and the internal situation is concerned? The reality is that despite all the slogans, all the calls that Tehran is making to expand its rule beyond the border, they are extremely weak and vulnerable inside the country. This is the untold story about Iran. This is a regime that is most vulnerable internally. There were some 5,000 anti-government demonstrations in Iran over the past 1 year. Ahmadinejad appeared before the Polytechnic University, which is also now known as Amir Kabir University, and they have brought in about half of the student hall was filled with the Revolutionary Guards who came from Imam Hussein University, which is really not a university. It's all training Revolutionary Guards. Hoping that, okay, this large presence of Revolutionary Guards in the hall would secure the place. They did not allow anyone who they suspected would be a problem into the hall. Yet, as soon as Ahmadinejad started speaking, They yelled at him, called him a dictator, a fascist. They burned his own pictures before his own eyes. They turned his pictures upside down. They shouted. And they basically shouted him out of the student hall. Teachers were on strike. Workers were on strike. There has been a lot of demonstration in Azerbaijan province, in the Kurdish region. All over the country, there's tremendous potential for change in Iran that is unprecedented anywhere else. There are some 120,000 members and supporters of the Iranian opposition who were actually killed by the Iranian regime. We were just talking earlier with one of your Iranian guests here about the mass execution in Iran in the summer of 1988, 30,000 were executed. These were members of the Iranian opposition. Why the regime has done that? Why there is a large wave of public hangings in Iran now in the past few weeks? Every day there is a report of 10 people, 12 people, 21 people hanged in public. Vast majority of them are young. And these are the people who were involved, many of them, in the anti-government demonstrations. The regime feels that unless they suppress this population, they are in big trouble. So I want to leave you with this word, that there's no need for the United States to send arms, to invade, to get in any kind of military action whatsoever. And there is no need for the continued fruitless negotiations with Tehran. There is a third option. And the third option, as has been stated by the Iranian opposition leader, Mrs. Maryam Rajavi, who actually made that very clear when she spoke before 50,000 in Paris, she said, no need for arm attack for a military strike. No need for continued negotiations. The people of Iran are ready for change. And the United States government need to recognize that. They need to unlock the hands of the opposition. When they put the main opposition on the terrorist list in 1997, they did that as a goodwill gesture to Tehran, to Khatami. that policy needs to be shattered, needs to be changed, and allow the tremendous potential of the Iranian people to flourish and to settle their course with the Ayatollahs in Tehran. In that way, both the problem of the nuclear threat of Iran, or what they're doing in Iraq, or what they're doing in the whole Middle East, will go away. Iran will turn from the main source of instability, terrorism, and chaos into the main source of hope, of aspirations for many countries in the region who could look at it and learn from this experience for democracy. Thank you very much.
I'll be hosting the question and answer. I just would like you to know that we're being photographed by Fora TV, that's FORA.TV, which I call YouTube for intellectuals. It covers events like this. You can sign up, go to Fora.TV, get an email. They'll send you all kinds of different events like this being covered. And it's a great site and a way to get the message out. If I could answer the first question, one of the issues that has not been discussed a lot is the minorities within Iran and their role in upsetting the Iranian regime. Could you discuss some of the minorities?
Sure, absolutely. There are various minorities in Iran where we know about the Kurdish population. We also have the Azeri population, not only in Azerbaijan province, but they are everywhere in Tehran and other places. We have the Baluchis southeast of the country. And they have all been very much, you know, the Arabs down south in Khuzestan province, the oil-rich province of Khuzestan, they have all been very dissatisfied with the Iranian regime because their rights are not respected. And they could all be a part of the larger objective of establishing democracy in the country, and they could all be very helpful in helping the main coalition that represents all the nationalities, the ambitions and the aspirations of the entire population. And none of that would be effective so long as the main opposition is handcuffed. So long as you have the leading opposition that operates in the entire country, it operates in the Kurdish region, it operates in the central part of the country in Tehran and other places, if the policy is not changed and the State Department continues to designate the main opposition as terrorists, all the efforts by the Kurdish population, by the Baluchis, and by the Arabs down south and other places will not go that far. So we need to have that in combination with a broader and larger effort.
Thank you. David?
Why are these opposition groups designated as terrorists by the American government? I don't understand that.
Well, there is a reason and there is an excuse. The real reason is that in 1997, the summer of 1997, Ahmadinejad was elected as a new president. And you recall at that time, you know, he was the big moderate and I'm sorry, Mohammad Khatami. Thank you for correcting me. We don't want him to be elected twice. Mohammad Khatami was elected as the new president of the Iranian regime, and he was the big moderate. And everyone was trying to do everything possible to reach out to Khatami. And only weeks after that, the State Department acted in designating the Mujahideen Khal as terrorists on the State Department list. And they said it very clearly that this is done as a goodwill gesture to Khatami and his new moderate president. That effort has clearly backfired. It didn't help the improvement of relations. It further emboldened Tehran. It was the same Khatami that actually helped with the development of the nuclear weapons. Most of the nuclear sites were built under Khatami. The site in Natanz in Iraq, in Lashkar-e-Abad, they were all at the time of Khatami. Now, the excuse is that, okay, this is a terrorist organization. They were involved in killing the Americans in the 70s, and they collaborated with the Iraqi government in suppressing the Shias down south and the Kurds up north. They have killed people in Iran, and therefore this is a terrorist organization. We just remember now that we have, after so many years, that we just have to designate them now. There was a lot of research done by independent experts, American experts, including that many of them are actually published. Look, going back to the now unclassified documents from those years, that actually those Americans who were killed in Iran at the time of the Shah, we're talking about 30 years ago, none of them were actually killed by the MEK, the Mujahideen Khalq. They were killed by a rival group that actually killed the leaders of the Mujahideen, who infiltrated the organization, killed their leaders, but also killed Americans. That they were not involved in the massacre, in the killing of the Kurds or the Shiites, and that they were not involved in killing civilians in Iran. They were always fighting the Revolutionary Guards in the country. And this was totally unfounded. And the fact that there's so much support all over the world for the opposition proves that this is not going to fly, and we need to look at the realities the way they are now.
Thank you. Lady, I'm sorry, I don't know your name.
I just wanted to ask you, how do you feel about the mistrust of the Iranian people against the Mujahideen? Because I get the feeling from your speech that you kind of support them, but they were the ones who actually helped the Islamic Republic come to power. For a couple of years, they were closely cooperating with that government. And there is other evidence that says that they did attack the Iranian side while they were in Iraq. So what about the mistrust? And also, they're coming from a religious point of view, just like the Islamic Republic. They are a religious group, if I'm not mistaken. I mean, you can tell from all the women wearing the scarf on their heads. I mean, none of the high-ranking women or women who are in the ashram are, like they're not secular-looking. So how do you feel about that? And what's your opinion?
Very good point. I appreciate that gave me the opportunity to address these issues. Certainly, I think any country you talk about, any opposition anywhere in the world, there are people who would disagree. I mean, this is the nature of democracy. People would have different views, and their views are very well respected. However, when it comes to the Iran-Iraq war, first of all, in addressing the issue of the overthrow of the Shah and their participation. They were opposed to the Shah. They were formed at the time of the Shah. They were opposed to the Shah's dictatorship, but they had clear lines with the Ayatollahs. They thought that the Ayatollahs' opposition was from a very backward mentality, whereas they thought that they should move the country forward. They should see progress, but not dictatorship. So even though both the mullahs and the MEK were opposed to the Shah, but they came from two opposing points of views. Right after the fall of the Shah, when the new government took place, if you recall, the situation was really mixed. Khomeini was not totally in charge. He had appointed the first prime minister, Bazargan, and a lot of liberals who were part of the government. He actually first claimed that he's just going to go back to Qom, and he's just going to be a simple cleric. He's not going to have any part in the government. And there were political freedoms in Iran right after the revolution. I was there myself, and many people, many reporters reported that. It took a while, for about 2 years before the Ayatollahs managed to purge all the moderate voices from the government and try to establish the institutions for repression. Because the Revolutionary Guards were formed after the revolution. It took them a while before they could really consolidate and really form the Revolutionary Guards and the Basij and all the different institutions of repression. And within that period, while Tehran was getting ready for that, the Mujahideen used the opportunity for the political process. They participated in the first elections. They used every opportunity to campaign and express their views. And they grew very fast, very rapidly, from a small political organization into a large social movement in a matter of a few months. In the first parliamentary elections, Masoud Rajavi, who was the leader of the Mujahideen at the time and was a candidate from Tehran, according to official figures, he got 520,000 votes, and despite all the electoral rigging. So they were right after the official Islamic Republic Party, the second party or the second political opposition in Iran were the Mujahideen. They organized rallies in different cities, in Mashhad, in Tabriz, in Rash and other places. They gathered a lot of support. On June 20, 1981, that was the day that there was the last the opportunity for any kind of peaceful activity, that they organized a demonstration attended by some 500,000 people, according to many Middle East experts who wrote books about this. And Tehran ordered the Revolutionary Guards to open fire on them. From then on, they went into a major confrontation resistance against the Ayatollahs. And what you're referring to about the violence that was going on was that the violence was waged by the Ayatollahs against them. They tried to stay away until June 20, 1981, that they had no choice. They had to either totally submit to the Ayatollahs and say, okay, you are the true representative of God on the face of the earth, and we will submit to you and we will follow you, or they would have to stand up and defend their national interests and fight the Ayatollahs, which they did. And as far as their Islamic view, they have endorsed a secular agenda. There are two entities. One is the Mujahideen Khal as an organization, and then the other one is the Parliament in Exile, of which the Mujahideen Khal are a part of. Now, the Parliament in Exile, the National Council of Resistance of Iran, is a secular entity. There are Muslims, Christians, Jews, Zoroastrians, and non-believers, many non-believers, who are part of this Parliament in Exile. 52% of the members of the Parliament in Exile are women, which is unprecedented, not only that part of the world, but even in Europe. You don't have that large level of participation of women. And they believe in the separation of church and state. When it comes to women's rights, they say women have to be free to choose their way of dressing. And they have to be free to in every aspect. So that's why they have a lot of women in key leadership positions, unprecedented anywhere else. So, as far as their agenda is concerned, they have committed themselves to a secular program, and I agree with you. The Iranian regime is doing a lot of propaganda, trying to muddy the water and try to create mistrust among the Iranians. Part of it is genuine, part of it is as a result, most of it I would say is a result of Tehran's propaganda. I know for a fact that Iran is spending millions and millions of dollars, not only to get rid of them and kill them and assassinate them, but they're doing campaign in different ways, trying to distort them. And because they are the main opposition, if they manage to get the Iranian population away from them, if they manage to get the policymakers in Washington and other places not to deal with the MEK, then they're fine, because they're already in power. And they try to insinuate this idea that there is no real opposition in Iran. So at the end of the day, you will have to go back and negotiate with them. The whole purpose is to dissuade you from supporting anything that would shake the foundation of the Ayatollahs, and then you would go back to the negotiating table.
Thank you very much. Alex, is
you? His opinion on Maliki, your opinion of Maliki.
I think Prime Minister Maliki, when he started, he committed to a platform that would bring national unity in Iraq. He committed himself to work with the Shias and the Sunnis and various factions in Iraq. But the fact of the matter is that the reality is that he is too close to Tehran, to the point that I believe he is actually acting on behalf of Tehran. B, not only he has not been able to create national unity, he is totally isolated himself among the Iraqis. 17 members of his own cabinet have already quit. It's the Iraqi voices who are saying, we don't want Maliki because he's pursuing a very sectarian line. He's empowering people from his own faction. This is not what he's supposed to do. He's supposed to act as the prime minister, unify and create that kind of atmosphere for all the voices to be heard and to participate. He has further strengthened the position of the militias in Iraq. His job was really to eventually be able to dismantle the militias. Why he can't do it? Well, he owes his position to those militias. So he never called really for this dismantle of the militias, and he has done nothing to stop that. So my view is really the view of many Iraqis themselves who say, you know, we need another solution. We need a totally different situation. Maliki has already failed, and we need to look for another alternative.
Thank you. Lee?
How worthwhile is it for us here in this country to pressure our pension funds, for instance, in trying to divest, or force them to divest from companies that do business in Iran? And how vulnerable also is Iran to economic pressure regarding refineries for oil and gas? Because my understanding is that while they have obviously a lot of capacity for oil, they are actually exporting or importing a lot of their oil and gas that that's refined.
Well, certainly the Iranian economy is in really, really bad shape. The inflation is high, and Ahmadinejad has only made things worse. So any kind of economic, any kind of sanctions when it comes to the Security Council, any kind of outside pressure will help expedite the process of change, including the divestment efforts. But this is not the solution. It only helps the solution, but it's not the solution by itself. The regime will not collapse as a result of economic pressure, but it is a very important, necessary part of the overall international approach. I think the Security Council need to act immediately in tightening sanctions on Tehran in terms of arms, oil, technological and diplomatic sanctions on Tehran, but you need to have to tighten political screws on Iran. Iran needs to have a political solution. And the United States, the European countries, the international community need to reach out to the Iranian population, to the Iranian opposition, to those who want to change things in Iran, and try to empower them, to strengthen them, to encourage them. Unless that policy is pursued, we're going to be stuck with the continued rule of the Ayatollahs, and things are only going to get worse.
Thank you. Let me ask one last question, Joe.
Okay, thank you. To what extent is there an opposition within the elites in Tehran? And I'm speaking about, for instance, the former mayor of Tehran, who would like to change the constitution and make it a little more liberal than it is. Something similar to when Iran started, you talked about 81, that period, even prior to that, when the first constitution was drafted, it had a lot of liberal elements. Some of these people that are part of the elite are trying to sort of come back, and they're opposing Ahmadinejad and his crew. To what extent is it real?
Well, the opposition is real.
The elite.
Right. Well, I don't know exactly what you mean by the elite. You know, we could have different definitions.
I'm talking about some of the clergy.
Right. If we're talking about the clergy, there are many clergy who are actually were not part of the regime, who are in Qum and other theological schools, who are very opposed, actually. Even the successor designate to Khomeini, Ayatollah Montazeri, who's been under house arrest for more than a decade in Qum, and he has from time to time made statements He is very critical. There are other prominent clerics in Qom and other places who are opposed to the regime. During the elections for the Assembly of Experts, which is consists of all clerics, there was a lot of infighting. You could tell what kind of discontent exists. However, what I would count on would be on the population itself. The ability of the population, especially the younger generation and the women, and the things that they have accomplished. They have created major, major uproars and waves in the country. During the student demonstration in the summer of 1999, it started with the students, but it expanded beyond Tehran universities. Just about all the universities in the country got involved in a matter of roughly about a week. And even the people in bazaar, the merchants, got involved. The middle class got involved. And until the Revolutionary Guards got engaged totally in bringing all their troops to suppress them, they had a chance to make much bigger progress if the Revolutionary Guards wouldn't come. So I think that's where I would really invest, not on very high level elite, but on the broad population, especially the younger generation, and the ability of the opposition to lead. Because no matter how much discontent is out there, nothing is going to happen unless you have organizations that have the ability to lead and move forward, that they have the experience of fighting the Ayatollahs and turn around the whole situation. So it's the combination of the social effort as widespread as possible and the ability of the opposition to lead. And that's why it's important for the international community to do everything possible to make it easier and more favorable for the opposition, to help them, not to tie their hands.
I said the last question, if I can take the prerogative and with your permission ask one question. Please. You mentioned there was a woman who spoke in Paris to 50,000 people. This is a striking statement. Who is she and who were these people and what is your interpretation of that?
Right. Well, there was an event on the 30th of June of this year in Paris, invited by many French parliamentarians and politicians. There were 50,000, mostly Iranians, but there were a lot of people from other nationalities who also participated. There were about at least 100 prominent dignitaries who got on the stage, members of the European Parliament, members of the British Parliament, other prominent personalities who threw their weight and their support behind this movement. Now, the main speaker of the event was Mrs. Maryam Rajavi. Maryam Rajavi has turned into the leader of the opposition. She was elected by the Parliament in exile, by the 500 member of the Parliament in exile, as the president-elect of the resistance for the transitional period. Her role, as she has said it repeatedly, is to unify Iranians from all backgrounds, all points of views, all different kinds of religion, political backgrounds, and to build this hope among the Iranians. In fact, her speech was about hope. Her speech that was about we shall win. It was combined with a very nice theme music at the end that we shall equivalent of we shall overcome, and he created so much hope in that place in Paris that when the speech ended, it ended in a major standing ovation of the whole crowd, the 50,000, which was broadcast actually live through satellite television into Iran and other places overseas. And then when the speech ended, the people were dancing and very jubilant. They felt that they can do it. They felt that there's so much power in the population, especially the younger generation of Iran, and we need to combine and integrate all the power and the resources we have for the future of Iran, and Iran that, as she said, that would have the separation of church and state, political freedoms, freedom of speech, freedom of political parties, equal rights for men and women, and respect for the international covenants. They felt so strongly that this is possible, it's going to happen, it can happen. And I think we should all have the same kind of attitude when looking at Iran, and not just looking at the Iranian threat, but the prospect for change, that we as the international community are able to help expedite change if we only pursue the right approach. And that change should come very soon before the Ayatollahs get the bomb.
Thank you very much.
I'd like to thank Bob Gazzardi and the Middle East Forum. I really appreciate the opportunity to speak here. I would like to invite all of you to a free and democratic Iran when the Ayatollahs are gone. You're more than welcome in my hometown in Mashhad, and welcome to my own home. Thank you.
Thank you.